Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as usual, we got lots to talk about, so let's get going. A milestone has been reached, and probably we never thought we'd see the day. This is a story that didn't get much press coverage, but it is momentous nonetheless. The Journal of the American Medical Association, which is basically the voice of conventional medicine, has recommended that patients who seek back pain treatment should also consider chiropractic care before taking invasive measures such as electing for surgery. Now, this is just something incredible, because mainstream medicine and chiropractic have been at loggerheads for literally generations. And I think it's worthwhile, and something that I'm going to go into in just a few moments, to look at the history, the sordid history between the AMA and chiropractic. Journal of the American Medical Association now says that the surgical option should only be considered if conservative therapies, for example, chiropractic, fail. According to JAMA, conservative alternatives like chiropractic care should be the first line of defense because they're safer and more efficient in relieving pain. How about that for a turnaround? Let me tell you a little bit about the background, because conventional doctors have long been vociferously opposed to chiropractic. They call it rank quackery, historically, they have recommended that patients stay the heck away from chiropractors. Just give you an example. I have an older relative. He's actually a neurologist. And his wife developed back and neck pain. And she told me that she'd asked her husband, well, you know, I'm thinking of going to a chiropractor. What do you think? And he says, don't do that. Don't go to a chiropractor. They can permanently injure you. They can cause severe neurologic damage. Don't even think about going to a chiropractor for your mild neck and shoulder pain. And so it was for many generations. And I'll give you a little history. Let's go back to something called the Wilk versus AMA case. It was a case in law. Now, in the Wilk versus AMA case, this goes back to 1980. A guy named Dr. Chester Wilk, who is a chiropractor, decided to push back against the discrimination against chiropractic by the American Medical Association. So he and four co-plaintiffs sued the American Medical Association. You see, until 1980, the AMA held that it was unethical for medical doctors to even associate with a, quote, unscientific practitioner, and they labeled chiropractic a, quote, unscientific cult. The AMA Principles of Medical Ethics stated, quote, a physician should practice a method of healing founded on a scientific basis, and he should not voluntarily professionally associate with anyone who violates this principle. So, actually, the first time, you know, I misstated, it was back in 1976 that Chester Wilk and four other chiropractors sued the AMA. And the plaintiffs lost at their first trial in 1981. They invoked the argument that the AMA's position on chiropractic was a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Okay, the Sherman Act basically says you can't have a monopoly. And if you conspire to maintain your monopoly, which Chester Wilk and the other chiropractors maintained, the government can intervene and basically bust the trust, break the monopoly, and rule in favor of the competition so that there is a free flow of commerce. Well, the plaintiffs, the chiropractors, lost the first trial in 1981. Then they obtained a new trial on appeal in 1983 because of some technicality. And what then happened was quite amazing because it took a long time for this to work its way through the courts. But in 1987, a judge, Susan Getzendanner, who is a beloved figure among chiropractors, she finally issued her opinion that the AMA had violated the Sherman Act and that it had engaged in an unlawful conspiracy in restraint of trade, and I'm quoting, to contain and eliminate the chiropractic profession. She further offered the opinion that, quote, the AMA had entered into a long history of illegal behavior. And what she didn't do, however, and she kind of went out of her way to make this clear, she didn't say that her ruling was a pronouncement that chiropractic was valid or effective or even a scientific healthcare service. And she said, look, I'm just a judge. If we want to establish whether chiropractic is effective, that can only be done by a well-designed, controlled scientific study. She said that as of 1987, no such study has ever been done. In the absence of such a study, her court is left to decide the issue on the basis of largely anecdotal evidence. So she said, I decline to pronounce chiropractic valid or invalid on anecdotal evidence. Clearly, the chiropractors wanted more from this case, but at least they got their way. Judge Getzendanner went on, though, and she said the plaintiffs point out that the anecdotal evidence in the record favors chiropractors. She said that the defendants have offered some evidence as to the unscientific nature of chiropractic. That's the AMA. But those studies really don't meet the threshold of adequate studies. So she's putting the burden of proof on the American Medical Association to come up with proof positive that chiropractic doesn't work, because in the absence of well-designed studies, she says that she could not adjudicate. She concluded that the AMA had been too restrictive in its campaign. They had something called a committee on quackery. She said that the AMA presented no evidence that a public education approach or any other less restrictive approach was beyond the ability or resources of the AMA or had been tried and failed. They say that the AMA and other medical societies have managed to change America's health-related conduct by what appears to be good public relations work. And there's been no proof that a similar campaign would not have been at least as effective as a boycott, i.e., you know, saying don't even associate with chiropractors, in educating consumers about chiropractic and the AMA's concern for scientific methods. So based on these findings, she, Judge Getzendanner, concludes that the AMA had failed to carry its burden of persuasion on the patient care defense. The AMA claimed that, oh, they were just trying to protect patients from the ravages of chiropractic. Well, interesting is that the AMA was defeated, but they appealed. And it took till 1990, years later, to get the final determination that indeed the AMA was in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act by enforcing a boycott of its professional membership against chiropractors, prohibiting them from associating with chiropractors, prohibiting doctors from referring patients to chiropractic. So that, in 1990, was the final turning point. And I actually met Chester Wilk many years ago, and he's a hero among chiropractors. What they're saying here, and this is now, fast forward, what are we talking about? This whole thing started in 1976, so we're talking over 35 years ago. The study that Judge Getzendammer said wasn't available at the time of the trial is now available. Actually, several studies have been done. There's a study out in a medical journal, Spine, that shows that sufferers of lower back pain who receive standard medical care versus chiropractic, and what they found was that in those who received standard and appropriate medical care, i.e. to make sure that they weren't, you know, so far gone that they couldn't be properly treated by chiropractors, the research found that in patients who received the additional chiropractic care reported that their pain was completely gone or much better after treatment compared to just 17% of the people who got standard medical care, whatever that is, I guess, you know, diagnosis and maybe some painkillers. So 73% better with standard medical care plus chiropractic versus just 17% who just got standard medical care. So how can physicians ignore those kinds of findings? Well, they can't. And that's why a turning point has finally been reached. Journal of the American Medical Association, in a milestone, has now recommended that patients who seek back pain treatment should consider chiropractic care and not go directly to surgery. Pretty interesting stuff. Okay, here's some reassuring news about vitamin E. You know, vitamin E is a fat-soluble vitamin, and certain fat-soluble vitamins have been found to be toxic at high doses. Vitamin A, for example, can cause serious toxicity if you take too much. Not the beta-carotene or mixed carotenoid form, but the retinol form of vitamin A can cause severe headaches, dry skin on the palms and around the mouth, cracking, and it can cause toxicity to the liver. Too much vitamin A might be something that increases the risk of osteoporosis even. So the routine amounts that are prescribed, not a problem. It's certainly potentially hazardous in pregnancy. You don't probably want to give more than 5,000, maybe at the most 10,000 international units of vitamin A to a pregnant lady. Can be a problem. Vitamin D, similarly, in the past it was thought that even relatively small doses could cause toxicity. The RDA for vitamin D for a long time was 400 international units. Now, more routinely, we recommend 2,000 international units, sometimes 5,000 international units for patients with special problems. They can take more as long as their vitamin D levels are monitored. But there have been some cases where people got poorly formulated vitamin D supplements that had many times more than the advertised amount of vitamin D. And this caused high levels of calcium to form in their tissues, causing severe pain, causing kidney stones, and that can be a problem. So we've got to temper our enthusiasm for vitamin D with caution because it's a fat-soluble vitamin. It can accumulate, like many fat-soluble vitamins. So let's turn our attention now to vitamin E. Vitamin E has been in the crosshairs lately because of some studies that suggest that vitamin E is not effective for some conditions. For a long time, the Shoot brothers from Canada told us that vitamin E was great for atherosclerosis, and then with recent testing, it was found to be less efficacious. Even some studies suggesting harm from vitamin E for certain conditions. Although these studies were poorly performed, and they used cheaper synthetic forms of vitamin E instead of the right kind of vitamin E, which is mixed tocopherol vitamin E that is rich in gamma tocopherol. But could too much vitamin E be a concern? Well, there's a new study performed by experts at the Linus Pauling Institute, Oregon State University. It was just published in the Journal of Lipid Research. And the headline here, excess vitamin E intake, not a health concern, study suggests. I repeat, not a health concern. What they're saying here is that a new review suggests that there are biological mechanisms that can actually help the body get rid of excess levels of vitamin E, thus making it almost impossible to take a harmful amount. So according to one of the lead researchers, Dr. Merit Traber, She says that taking too much vitamin E is not the real concern. A much more important issue is that more than 90% of the people in the United States have inadequate levels of vitamin E in their diets. Why? The major sources of vitamin E are fresh nuts and foods like avocados, and it can be found in meat, in some other foods, whole grains, but not refined grains. And therefore, the vast majority of Americans don't eat that type of food, and vitamin E levels can be inadequate. It's an important antioxidant. It's vital for the functioning of many organisms, many organs, and in particular, nerves. It also can act as a mild anticoagulant that can reduce blood clotting. So the researcher here says toxic levels of vitamin E in the body simply do not occur. While that's possible for fat-soluble vitamins such as vitamins A and D, it's not possible for vitamin E to overaccumulate in the liver or other tissues. So important for immunity, important for eye health, important for brain health, important for the heart. Make sure you take adequate amounts of mixed tocopherol vitamin E. I personally take about 800 to 1,000 international units of mixed tocopherol vitamin E. Some people would say that's a little high. But actually, from studies, we're not even sure what the optimal amount of vitamin E might be. I've been taking that amount for years, and I don't seem to be coming to any harm, that's for sure. I think I'm doing pretty well from many standpoints. We recently did a great interview with Dr. Jared Scowron, who's a naturopathic physician who specializes in the diseases of childhood, and he's written a great book about natural remedies for kids. And during that interview, we discussed what to do for kids who are coming down sick. This story is a little bit of a footnote to that discussion, because it's clear that we give our kids too many inappropriate medications when natural therapies or just a little bit of active surveillance or watchful waiting could tide kids over when they have minor health problems. The headline, 40% of parents give young kids cough cold medicine that they shouldn't. Children get a lot of colds every year, so it's not surprising that adults often turn to over-the-counter cough and cold medicines when kids are coughing and feeling uncomfortable. According to the latest University of Michigan Mott Children's Hospital National Poll on Children's Health, more than 40% of parents reported giving their kids under age 4 cough medicine or multi-symptom cough and cold medicine. And 25% gave their children decongestants. Now, decongestants can get you kind of hopped up or stimulated. That's not great for kids. Studies show that these cough and cold products, they're inefficacious. Some of them can actually get your kid a little stoned. So I guess, you know, you might sedate the kid with high doses of antihistamines and a little bit of alcohol. But that's not really great for a young kid. In response to the FDA, manufacturers of over-the-counter cough and cold products changed their labels back in 2008. FDA required them to do so to state that the medicine should not be used for children under 4 years old. According to one of the lead researchers, Dr. Matthew Davis, he says these products don't reduce the time the infection will last, and misuse could lead to serious harm. What can be confusing, however, is that often these products are labeled prominently as, quote, children's medications. And you have to look at the fine print to see where parents and caregivers should not be giving kids under 4 these medications. So it's a big labeling. It's children's formula, yada, yada, yada. But then very tiny print somewhere on the back. Our instructions saying these are not to be used in children under 4. Side effects from the use of cough and cold medicines in young children can include allergic reactions, increased or uneven heart rate, drowsiness or sleepiness, slow and shallow breathing, confusion or hallucinations, convulsions, nausea, and urinary retention and constipation, because they do affect digestion and the smooth muscles in the bladder. So, you know, products like these may work to some extent for adults, and parents then extrapolate. They think, well, this could help my kid as well. But what's good for adults, or not even that great for adults, but at least, you know, there's nothing like, you know, you're coughing your brains out, you take an alcohol and decongestant combo with some antihistamine, and you're going to feel knocked out. You know, it's kind of, you know, it's, you feel, I'm feeling lousy, I'm entitled to my NyQuil or whatever. But these medications are inappropriate for kids. Now let's jump from medications that are inappropriate for kids to medications that are inappropriate for pregnant moms. Well, there's a lot of esoteric medications, you know, for special problems that we know are not a great idea to give to moms during pregnancy. So whenever you're considering taking medication, check with your doctor. But sometimes the decision to take a medication doesn't involve a doctor. You just have a health problem and you find yourself in the aisle of a drugstore and medications present themselves, which seem to be innocuous. And such are decongestant medications. They're very popular. They come in various forms. They come as pills. They come as sprays. And a new study suggests that decongestant use in pregnancy is linked to birth defects. Think of the implications of that. Think of how many women casually take decongestants. They get a cold or they have a sinus problem, allergies, and boom, they're taking decongestants. They're found in products like Sudafed. They're also found in weight loss products. Phenylpropylamine, PPA, is an ingredient in Accutrim, and it was linked to an 8-fold risk of defects of the ear and stomach in the babies of women who take it. First semester use of phenylephrine, which is found in Sudafed, was tied to an 8-fold higher risk of heart defect called an endocardial cushion defect. That normally requires perinatal heart surgery, which is a big deal. The use of imidazolines, which are found in nasal decongestant sprays, and even eye drops. Think, vasoconstrictor eye drops, get the red out. These were tied to an approximate doubling of the risk for an abnormal connection between the trachea and the esophagus. Now, we got to keep this all in perspective because these birth defects are relatively rare. So we're not talking about kids coming out left and right with all kinds of defects. But this is an unnecessary risk to undergo if you're pregnant. And in addition, I mean, these medications are typically widely available for use without a prescription. They don't require a consultation with a healthcare provider. So I'm not even sure that OBGYNs are reading this article or are aware of this and are making pregnant women or women contemplating pregnancy aware of these widespread potential reactions, because these medications are virtually ubiquitous and people think nothing of taking these eye drops, nasal sprays, diet pills, and decongestants, right? I mean, it's not a big deal, we think. But not a good idea in pregnancy. Now, the other point to be made is among the worst medications are nasal decongestant sprays. They account for widespread problems, including a medical condition that is caused precisely by their use. It's got a fancy name. It's called rhinitis medicamentosa. And it has to do with the fact that when you take these medications, they work for a while, but when they wear off, your nasal congestion comes back like gangbusters. I know, because I've tried these medications, and as a broadcaster, there's nothing that sounds worse than a stuffy doctor right? Stuffed up. You know, it's one thing if you're like a financial guy and you go on the radio, you say, look, I'm a little congested today. But if you're a doctor, you're supposed to be invincible. So at various times during my career, I've tried these nasal sprays. They're terrible because they also dry your throat and irritate it. And when they wear off, you're hooked. And that's great for business. What a great business model. A medication that works for a while, really works great. But you need more and more and more to continue to have the decongestant effect. And it is really a bear for doctors like me when I see patients who are hooked on these medications. Very hard to wean them off. They're hooked. It's like being hooked on heroin. Very hard to go through the withdrawal because the withdrawal produces lots of nasal congestion. Sometimes we take these patients and we put them temporarily on prescription steroid nasal sprays, which I'm also not crazy about. But at least these steroid nasal sprays afford us an opportunity to wean the patients off the decongestants that they're hooked on. And then we can gradually wean them off of their steroid nasal sprays using a product like Clear Sinus Spray. It's called XLEAR. This is a much preferable way to deal with the problem of nasal congestion. Sometimes you have to do some homework, find out what a person is allergic to. That is a big factor in whether people are allergic and have chronic stuffy nose, or sometimes give them sublingual drops called SLIT, sublingual immunotherapy, which is a way of getting the immune system to settle down when you have extreme reactions to dust, mold, pollen, dogs or cats. Sublingual immunotherapy obviates the need to get shots. That's something that we've been doing for 25 years at the Hoffman Center with a safe track record and effectively for many patients suffering from chronic allergies. But decongestants in pregnancy, just say no. And if you don't know what a decongestant ingredient is, check with the pharmacist to see whether it's okay to take during pregnancy. Sickle cell anemia is a terrible disease. It affects predominantly African Americans or Africans because it's actually a genetic adaptation to the presence of malaria-carrying mosquitoes. It turns out that if you have one gene for sickle cell anemia and one normal gene, you don't have too many problems, but you do get an additional benefit of relative immunity from malaria. This can make a big difference for survival in equatorial regions. That's why this particular mutation developed. But if, unfortunately, you get one gene from each parent and you get a double hit of the sickle gene, you develop sickle cell anemia, which is a horrible disease. It's something that I saw a lot of when I studied medicine in the Bronx. At Jacoby Hospital, there were patients who came in for multiple admissions with excruciating symptoms. It was heartrending because these patients were all addicted to painkillers. And you know that there's a prejudice against people who are addicted to painkillers in medicine. Sometimes you just think that they're dope addicts who are looking to get high. But these patients would have excruciating sickling crises where what happens is the blood clumps within the blood vessels, and this causes really, really painful episodes. Sometimes resulting in gangrene or amputations, most often resulting in severe anemia requiring blood transfusions. These are a very, very unhappy lot. And there's very little that can be done other than to reduce the symptoms of patients with sickle cell anemia. Nothing definitive to cure the disease. Maybe in the future we'll be able to modify people's genes, do gene splicing, and ultimately correct the underlying genetic defect. But there's not much that can be done in conventional medicine. All right, here's an exciting study, simple intervention for patients with sickle cell disease. It was tried out in Africa, in the Sudan, and it's in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, 2013. 140 patients in Sudan had sickle cell disease, and they were randomly assigned to receive either one capsule for age 2 to 4, two capsules age 5 to 10, three capsules for age 11 to 16, or four capsules age 17 years or older of omega-3 fatty acids. The capsules are rather, I think, weak compared to the ones that we use, just 278 milligrams of DHA and 39 milligrams of EPA. Actually, these capsules were engineered to have more DHA than EPA. Usually it's the opposite. You know, most standard fish oil capsules have more EPA than DHA, but this one was stacked towards the DHA. And what they found was that there was a dramatic reduction in the number of what are called vaso-occlusive events, where the cells sickle, you know, they clump together and cause severe pain and poor circulation. There was a major reduction in severe anemia. In the users of the sickle cell, I'm sorry, in the users of fish oil, it was just 3%. In the ones who didn't use fish oil, it was 16%. And the proportion of patients who required blood transfusions, just 4% in the users of omega-3 and 16% in the ones who didn't get omega-3. The omega-3 fatty acids rich in DHA also decreased by 60% the number of patients who were unable to attend school at least once during the study because of illness related to the disease. So while it didn't cure it, it ameliorated the crises. Patients were more functional. They had less anemia, less requirement for transfusions, which probably very hard to get in impoverished parts of Africa. And the current study suggests that, you know, what are we doing when we omit prescribing omega-3 fatty acids for these patients? In my current practice, I don't see a lot of patients who have sickle cell anemia because I don't work in underserved areas of the country where there are a lot of African-American patients who suffer from this condition. But we got to get the word out and provide, you know, proper subsidies. You know, we're giving people food stamps for nutrition. We should be giving people some type of government assistance or credit so that they can afford even relatively inexpensive supplements rich in DHA and EPA that can help thin their blood and prevent these painful crises. Well, we already know that air pollution is bad for us. It can cause a wide variety of medical conditions. It certainly is associated with chronic sinusitis and asthma and the risk of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. It may even be responsible for cardiovascular disease because the tiny particles that we breathe actually find their way from the lungs into our bloodstream, and they can literally cause our blood vessels to constrict because of their toxic properties. There may be, and most certainly likely is, a connection between air pollution and certain forms of respiratory cancer. So there's a lot that air pollution can do, perhaps increase the incidence of stroke, maybe even neurological disease because of the toxins that get into our bodies and may damage the delicate nerves within our brain. So on and on it goes. You know, we're quite aware of the deadly toll that pollution can cause. But get ready for this, folks. This is truly bizarre, and I didn't see this one coming. According to an article in the New York Times by Nicholas Bacalar, science reporter, air pollution may raise appendicitis risk. According to a new report, they did this in Canada, they looked at air pollution data from monitors in each city to calculate the daily maximum exposure to ozone in Canadian individuals, quite a lot of them, nearly 36,000 of them who were hospitalized for appendicitis. And what they found was high ozone levels were associated with an increased number of hospitalizations for appendicitis, number one. Number two, the worst case scenario, burst appendix, which is a true medical emergency. It causes peritonitis, can kill you. That was even more strongly associated with high levels of pollution. So they did a little calculation. They found that for each 16 parts per billion increase in ozone concentration, that's the way they measure it, the scientists found an 11 to 22% increase in ruptured appendix cases. Now, they really don't know what's going on here. The reason for the association is unclear. But they've already done studies in mice that show that air pollution can alter the animal's abdominal bacteria. And bad bacteria in your intestinal tract are precisely what can lead to an infection and can cause your appendix to get all inflamed and ultimately to burst. So if we want to prevent appendicitis, we got to clean up our air to protect our vulnerable populations. Funny, I grew up in Los Angeles, now live in New York, two of the most polluted places on earth. Funny thing, I still have my appendix. I guess it must be all those probiotics I'm still taking. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoppen. Thanks very much for joining us. Make sure you join us for our next edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.